A podcast of the cinema.
Bonus episode.
Happy New Year.
If this is your first time listening, go away.
Probably not a good place to start.
This is not the episode for you because it's just going to be all the mail.
Yes. Well, most of the mail.
Some of the mail.
Yes. A chunk of the mail.
A fraction of the mail.
Mail parts. That sounds wrong.
It does.
Anyway, you know. So, welcome.
First of all, tell the people, call you by your name.
I was going to do that. I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I'm the film reviews editor for The Wrap, and I'm a co-host of What the Flick on the Young Turks Network, and a co-host of Who Shot Ya on the Maximum Fun Network. And you, sir?
Dave White, the film critic as well.
Yes.
The Wrap and... different places.
That's right.
Today, primarily, I'm cleaning the kitchen. Cleaning out the pantry.
You're digging, yeah.
It's been quite a day.
You're digging deep into that storage area.
As tiny as it is. I'm not even going to talk about it until we get to the other, like, there's a whole food podcast to discuss this on.
Okay, fine.
It also connects to a Linoleum Nights episode that we did called Swedish Death Cleaning.
It's all interwoven into the other shows that you have to subscribe at Patreon to get.
And the book came today.
You're so excited about... oddly enough, you're excited about a new object, even though that object is all about getting rid of objects.
Well, you know, just spend money to make money.
Whatever
that means.
Mm-hmm.
I
guess that's why we don't make any money.
I'm not going to become a minimalist.
No.
I
won't let you.
But I'm really into the idea of learning a gentle art.
And it can't be flower arranging.
Why not? It could be.
You've
what if I decided?
Instead.
What if I decided to take up flower arranging?
Wouldn't
you enjoy having beautiful flowers
that.
In our home all the time?
I would champion that, but no, the gentle
having
art,
me arrange them.
The gentle art you have decided to embrace is the gentle art of Swedish death cleaning, because it combines two of your favorite things:
cleaning
and death.
I do a lot of cleaning, and I think a lot about death. Usually, my home. Sometimes yours.
So this book will apparently prepare you to leave behind a beautiful corpse and as few possessions as possible for loved ones to sift through.
I've already read the introduction to the book.
Uh-huh.
It's a slim volume.
Yes. Very Swedish, though.
But I don't think that it is necessarily about leaving behind a tiny number of things. I think it's about removing unnecessary items from your life, things you no longer care about or use or like.
But it's not that condo ridiculousness.
I don't believe it is.
Do these porcelain bells bring me joy?
Right. Probably. They're porcelain bells, after all. They make pretty noises.
That's right.
My understanding as I get into the first, chapter is that it's a book about what things in your life you value and what should happen to those things when you go, so that other people aren't left wondering,
what do I do with all these porcelain bells?
What do I do with all these porcelain bells? Let's say that you collect porcelain bells. I do not. Don't nobody send me no porcelain bells. He just made that up.
That was just a hypothetical, I promise.
This is the letters episode.
Yes,
we are no longer going to discuss the gentle art of Swedish death cleaning.
We are gently cleaning out our mailbox.
We are going to discuss that on Linoleum Nights.
Yes. So patreon.com/linoleumknife if you want that. And if you want Linoleum Knife and Fork, we'll be talking about cleaning out the pantry. So many exciting things to look forward to. We really know how to tease out the material.
Everything we do is cool and fascinating.
Well, or fodder in any event.
Right.
So yes, letters from you, our listeners.
Now, these letters have been piling up.
They have indeed.
Here's why. First of all, there's a lot of you. Seven years ago, I never would have imagined that so many of you would give a damn about this podcast.
It's been an ongoing surprise.
And sometimes, y'all write some long-ass letters. And I don't feel right about, like, just chopping them up and reading a paragraph and telling you to, you know, keep it brief next time. So sometimes the long ones just sit in the mailbox for a while until we have a minute.
Yeah.
So you're going to be hearing letters about things like a ghost story, for example.
Keeping it timely.
Someone wrote a long letter about Detroit, I think, as well, that we haven't gotten to yet.
Not on this one, but we'll be getting to it soon.
And so, let's begin with the Scrooge.
Sure.
Since it just used to be Christmas.
Yes.
Remember when it was Christmas?
The tree's still standing.
Well, kind of.
It's drooping, but it's still standing.
It's a husk.
It's
right now.
It is tragically perpendicular at the moment.
I have taken all the heaviest, most easily in danger ornaments off this week, not yet Epiphany, which means it's not yet time to touch anything in the house and get rid of it, according to the rules of Alonzo Duralde.
12th night, Dave White.
Correct. All right, this letter. It comes from James. It is about Scrooge.
Mm-hmm.
Here's my problem with Scrooge. Alonzo's favorite film version of A Christmas Carol. In the book, by the time Scrooge meets the ghost of Christmas yet to come, his change is almost complete. This spirit never speaks, so Scrooge provides his own narration about what he's seeing and what lesson it holds for him. Before the ghost shows him his name on a headstone in the graveyard, Scrooge asks the spirit whether these visions might be changed, because he wants to change them. By contrast, at this point in Scrooge, Ebenezer is as clueless and self-absorbed as ever. The first thing the spirit shows him is a crowd of people happy that Scrooge is dead and that their debts will be erased. But Scrooge never understands this. He sees a crowd of people celebrating him. "I had no idea how much they loved me," he crows before joining the jubilant up-tempo song and dance number. Scrooge learns nothing from this moment. Alonzo, would you sing a little bit of that dance number? Just a bit, just a bit. Give people a taste, a delicious taste.
"Thank you very much. Thank you very much. That's the nicest thing that anyone's ever done for me."
Okay, stop. I'll tell you something about this particular number. It is jubilant. People do jump up and down in the streets and they
carry on.
They carry on, yeah. It's as close to Oliver as the Who Will Buy number. Now you have to wait until the end to get a super mega dose of the Who Will Buy number, because that's when everybody in this movie comes out of their house and sings and dances in the streets. It's kind of magnificent. Let's continue this letter. After seeing that Tiny Tim has died, Scrooge does muster a quick "poor Tiny Tim" before turning the conversation back to himself. "Where am I in this future? What? I'm dead? Oh no, spirit, I repent." What's he repenting? He's expressed no remorse, no desire to change. In the book, Scrooge sees how people have reacted to his death coldly and indifferently, and that's his final motivation. Here it is. Here, it is the death itself. He doesn't want to die.
Yeah.
So he repents. Hang on. Then he goes to hell and sees what his eternity there would be like. That is what makes this Scrooge change. Not love, not kindness, not a sense of responsibility to his fellow man. Just fear of everlasting torment. If that's all this version has to say, we didn't need to waste time with those three spirits. Marley's ghost essentially handles the job by himself. To the movie Scrooge, I say, bah humbug. To the cast and crew of Linoleum Knife and its multiple subsidiaries, I say, Merry Christmas. James, Charlottesville, Virginia. James, okay, sure, you're right.
I think that the reason...
But come on!
I think the reason for that is because they want the hell sequence, which does not exist in the book, to be the turning point. But I don't think that it's strictly the fear of hell that is making him change. I think it's the idea of... I think it's the turnabout of being treated by... Of knowing that he'll be treated by Satan the way he has treated Bob Cratchit that turns him around. And I think that there have been little chinks in the armor all along with the, you know, witnessing, you know, the fun at Fred's house that he's never participated in and, you know, the other stuff.
Yeah, that minister's cat game is a corker.
Exactly. You know, the whole visit with the ghost of, you know, seeing, I think, you know, you see him remembering the Fezziwig stuff and how much that meant to him. You see him, you know.
The lady that left him.
Yeah, the you know, the Belle Fezziwig and you know, like, spending time with the Ghost of Christmas Present and realizing...
The sexy Ghost of Christmas Present would have convinced me right there. I'd have been like, can we just hang out for the rest of the time?
I mean...
Like, can you come live in my house, maybe? Bring all this food. Just wear that robe all day. We'll get along just fine. You and me.
So yeah, I think the plot beats are different than are differently laid out than they are in Dickens, but I think that it the cumulative effect remains the same. But whatever, you have a point.
Okay, sure. I mean, yeah, he's right. He's absolutely right. And at the same time, who cares?
Pretty much. Yeah, I don't care.
People are singing.
Yes.
Those last 17 minutes is nothing but people singing.
Mm-hmm.
They're jumping around. They're dancing. They love him. He loves them. They all love Christmas. They're going to get presents. They're eating. He's dressed like Santa Claus. Come on.
He's going to go to Fred's for lunch?
He's going to Fred's for lunch. They're going to play the minister's cat again.
It's going to be awesome.
Ain't nobody get enough of that game.
But thank you for your special thoughts, James. We appreciate it. Thanks for ruining Christmas.
No. James provides vital
counterpoint
mm-hmm. to your ridiculousness.
How am I ridiculous? You're the one who turned me on to this movie in the first place.
Shh. You're the one that wrote a book about it.
Okay, fine.
This one is from Alex. It is about a ghost story. This letter came in September. Sorry. Hi, guys. I don't mean to add to an exhaustive pile of letters about a ghost story, but I felt compelled to after hearing the two letters on the latest episode. I absolutely loved 95% of the film. The 5% being the insufferable hipster who explains the themes of the movie. The movie was not so impenetrable as to warrant that, yet that kind of explanation would, of course, be even less welcome in something more challenging like Upstream Color or Holy Motors. Someone should really just make an edit of the film omitting that scene. However, I did not find the settler section or the Hispanic family section to be problematic in the way that previous letter writers did, though I understand where they were coming from. Not giving the family subtitles for their Spanish, I appreciated for two reasons. First, I found subtitles unnecessary, because the direction and the performances made it so that I basically got what they were saying in any given scene. This drew me into the characters, and the family, especially the children, are shot with such intimacy and care, I do not buy for one second that the filmmaker finds them unimportant. Secondly, because there were subtitles when Ghoulie Affleck communicated with the neighbor ghost. I interpreted it as he understood ghost language, but he couldn't understand the Hispanic family, which further exacerbated his feeling of isolation and loneliness.
Hmm.
Films often don't provide subtitles when they want to emphasize the protagonist's sense of alienation when in a strange land. Additionally, there is a difference between the objective point of view of the filmmaker and the point of view of the protagonist. The actions and words of characters do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the person who writes these characters. They can compartmentalize. Ghoulie Affleck throwing a... This is such a funny name. Hey, Ghoulie.
Ghoulie.
Ghoulie Affleck throwing a temper tantrum at a Hispanic family and not explicitly doing the same thing to white people does not mean that David Lowery is racist. Ghoulie Affleck was a new angsty ghost when living with the Hispanic family. We have no real idea how much time has passed when he's walking around that hipster party as that dirty, insufferable man. The great Will Oldham was who that was. Rambles on. He's probably tired and has wised up / given up. In regards to the settler section, the family that we briefly focus on is clearly made out to be a peaceful and loving family and should not necessarily be held accountable for the heinous crimes of those who came before them. Maybe. Okay. Previous letter writers were labeling that specific family as villains, and that is definitely not the case. Are they coming onto land that is not theirs? Yes. But their intentions are not malicious. The hard cut from when we just start to hear the distant cries of approaching Native Americans to the image of the family lying dead is incredibly affecting, and a fully fleshed out scene of the natives charging into their camp and killing them would have not had nearly as much weight and would not at all have been in keeping with the film's tone and pace. So I absolutely disagree that it was done out of tentativeness, unwillingness to portray natives correctly. And of course the natives are going to attack them. Not only did it happen frequently to settlers in history, but this is a film about death and about how the world doesn't care about you or your plans. The Native Americans are not going to walk up to an ignorantly invasive settler family, welcome them to the plains, and give them a bunch of snacks. Or I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Well, I think maybe they might have thrown in a scene of those same, you know, Native Americans getting slaughtered by, you know, U.S. Army soldiers or something, so that their deaths would have the same weight.
Perhaps.
Just a thought.
He continues, I thought you guys might appreciate this. Your new favorite screenwriter, Alan Loeb, is my neighbor's first cousin.
Oh, wow.
I can find out whatever you want. Just kidding. Maybe.
Tell me everything.
Thanks so much for your time, Alex.
Somebody on Facebook, when I was goofing on Alan Loeb, was like, he's very nice.
Well, I'm sure he's very nice.
And I'm like, well, great. Bully for him.
Listen, we're reasonably nice. That doesn't mean we're amazing at what we do.
Exactly.
It means we're just kind of nice.
There are a lot of friendly people who should have other lines of work.
No. Alan Loeb should be doing exactly what he's doing, because it gives me pleasure.
I suppose.
Without Alan Loeb, there would have not been a film called The Space Between Us.
True.
With a boy whose bones are made of outer space candy and break very brittle, and he has to be operated on while in zero gravity in space.
On Who Shot You? I was talking about that movie, and I mentioned candy bones. And Ricky's like, wait, what? And April had to go, they're not really made of candy. But wouldn't it be great if they were?
Figuratively speaking.
They are.
They are.
Yes. These one big Necco wafer.
Yeah. Alex. Pour the tea.
Please.
Please.
But a point well taken on Ghost Story. Thank you for sharing.
Okay. Here's a... Jacob. Jacob says, Dear Mr. Knife from the Linoleum Dynasty, I just got done listening to the podcast of December 5th and wanted to comment about these Soviet Christmas ornaments. They are not for Christmas, but for New Year's.
Mm.
You would put them on your New Year's tree to welcome in the New Year. Soviet New Year was de facto secular Christmas in aesthetics and practice. New Year tree, decorations, Santa, actually two Santas, the one we're familiar with, and Dead Moroz, the Slavic equivalent. New Year's cards, gift giving, especially to children, forest animal cartoons, large family dinners, just with more hammers and sickles.
I think one of the Santas might be Jack Frost.
Really?
Yeah, after getting this letter, I encountered something else that was about sort of Soviet, not Christmas.
This letter, in case no one understands what's being discussed right now, was we offhandedly mentioned a
cosmonaut,
a vintage Soviet cosmonaut Christmas tree ornament that I bought from someone in the Ukraine on eBay. It's one of those great old clip-on ornaments where you just clip it to the branch and it stands up. And it's just, it's beautiful. It's like this, it's glass and it's painted glass and it's a little astronaut. And
is that the one where the package arrived?
It arrived twine? In a package from the Ukraine, secured solely with twine. Yeah. So cool. Anyway, that's what he's talking about. New Year became more or less Christmas after the Soviet Union established an anti-religious holiday to be the 31st of each month as a replacement to the religious ones in the beginning of the USSR, with the Christmas tree being prohibited in accordance with anti-religious laws. People supplanted the former Christmas custom with New Year's trees, becoming more widespread from 1935 onwards. Why 1935, you say? In December of 1935, Pavel Postyshev, a party functionary in Kiev, wrote a letter in Pravda saying, "In the pre-revolutionary era, the bourgeoisie and the capitalist officials always put up a tree for their children on New Year. Children of the working classes looked on with envy through the windows at the gleaming tree adorned with colored lights and the children of the rich playing around it. Why do our schools, orphanages, nurseries, children's clubs, and young pioneer palaces..." I don't know what a young pioneer palace is, but it sounds fantastic. Especially if it is an actual palace.
Well, it's a communist thing, so probably not quite what you're thinking.
I don't know. Anyway, why should they deprive children of the working class of the Soviet state of this wonderful enjoyment? Because some left-leaning exaggerators decried this pastime as a bourgeois children's indulgence, it is time to put an end to this wrongful condemnation of the tree, which is a joyful diversion for the children. The letter goes on to say, "City councils, chairmen of district executive committees, village councils, and education authorities must all work to bring the new year to children of our great socialist motherland." I agree.
This is reminding me of when the Catholic missionaries would come in and try and convert, like, the Latin American populations who had previously, you know, worshipped different pagan deities.
Right.
And so what they would do was just, like, dress up their pagan deity as, like, Saint Teresa, you know, and they would have, like, a big Saint Day celebration, but they were actually still doing their old pagan celebration, and the dumb Catholic missionaries were none the wiser. It's like, yeah, it's a New Year's tree. For New Year's.
For New Year's. Listen, call it Christmas, call it New Year's, just I need the tree.
Yes.
I need the tree. I own a lot of ornaments.
Well, you're a hero, Pavel.
And one of my ornaments is communist.
Yes.
And not really for Christmas. When I say my, I mean yours. Yours and mine.
Yes.
We together.
Our.
The team.
The collective.
The homosexual collective of marriage.
Yes.
The contractually in agreed, our, agreed upon.
In our young pioneer palace.
Yes. Ian says, "Couple of things. I have just binge listened today to 3 episodes. 2 Linoleum Knives and 1 LKTV. And the first part of this letter is about something we talked about on LKTV.
Yeah, it's probably one of the ones that we made available to the general public. So
perhaps.
Go ahead.
I'm going to have to check out Village of the Damned, even though I'm not a true crime guy. Dryden, New York, is basically the next town over from Ithaca and Cornell, and I was there from 1988 to 1993, so I overlapped with at least some of those murders. Let me tell you, though, having grown up in New York City, upstate New York, right outside of Ithaca, was my introduction to nearly all white spaces and Confederate flags everywhere. So it might not be my idea of idyllic, but I understand what the show is going for. That letter from Natalia. Wow. Any chance you can mention Radio Free Qtopia to her, given I'm doing episodes about LGBT human rights in the former USSR?
Well, we just did.
Radio Free Qtopia. Natalia.
Natalia's the one who wrote in. And
I don't know about Radio Free Qtopia, so I need to check that out.
I believe
out myself.
At the bottom of the email, he's got like a link and stuff.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, there it is. Oh, Ian is the host of it.
Yes.
Well, that's weird. I know Ian personally, and we have never discussed this. good news for Dave. I can't yet find $20 a month in my budget for the top level of Patreon, but I'll see about upping to $7 a month once my new salary kicks in, even if my vegetarian sensibilities aren't the stuff of fork dreams. Oh, you don't know, because I am always making the veggie things.
That's right.
And talking about them on fork.
We also talk about brining pork, but, you know.
By the way, the first time I heard Knife and Fork, Alonzo adding fork in the opening music cracked me up way too much.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Ian. He is the host and producer of Radio Free Qtopia, radiofreeqtopia.org.
All right.
He is also the author of the forthcoming book from UNC Press, Queer and Present Dangers, Sexuality, Masculinity in the 60s.
Well.
He's smart.
Congrats.
All right. Special request from Paul. He says, your theme song is great, but in light of your review of Gary Oldman Wants an Oscar, can you replace la 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 in your theme song to simply Alonzo imitating Gary Oldman impersonating Winston Churchill? The gargled British gobbledygook was epic and deserving of its own award. Phil says, regarding the disaster artist, Would that it were so simple. Do it fast.
Would that it were so simple. Would that it were so simple.
Would that it were so simple.
Would that it were so simple.
Tommy Wiseau's laughs in the movies. I'm sorry. Tommy Wiseau's laughs in the movie The Room always struck me as a mirthless chuckle, at which the double reference made me laugh twice as hard.
Ha 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 ha. She wound up in a hospital on Guerrero Street. Ah, ha, ha, ha.
Jess is asking me if I'm okay.
Are you?
I am. But then, it continues, you didn't list Bresson when you talked about your favorite directors, and now I'm afraid you have had a neurological incident. Well, here's what
an episode?
I was talking about my favorite living directors.
Ah.
Bresson is no longer on this planet.
True.
But Claire Denis is.
Yes.
And Chai Ming Lang is. And Apichat Pong Wirasethakul is. And Hu Xiaoxian is. They are all alive. All y'all need to be watching their movies.
Speaking of Bresson, did you get the thing I just forwarded you?
You did. There's going to be a nice a thing on Filmstruck.
The Criterion Channel.
I actually believe I have seen it already.
Oh, okay. It might already be an extra on
because
the Ohasard Balthasar.
There is an extra on the Ohasard Balthasar
Criterion disc
that is an interview from French television with him.
Ah, okay.
But I'd sure watch it again.
Okay.
Oh, speaking of that,
mm-hmm.
UCLA at the Hammer Museum. Yes, that's Armie Hammer's family's museum here in Los Angeles. I'm not kidding.
Yes.
His grandfather, great-grandfather,
was Armand Hammer.
Powerfully wealthy person named Armand Hammer.
Yes.
And yes, the baking soda.
Yes.
Yeah. See all these connections? Anyway, they're showing Ohasar Baltasar in 35mm.
Oh, are they?
Within the next, like, month or 6 weeks.
Hmm.
Oh, we're going.
Oh, are we?
We. You and me.
By the way,
we'll get some pot roast at Denny's across the street before we get there. God, that pot roast at Denny's is so good.
I don't know why you're so... Anyway.
It's on that garlic toast. Oh, man. Mashed potatoes on top of garlic toast and then pot roast on top of it.
Speaking,
if you eat meat, this is the jam.
Speaking of repertory cinema, I just found out.
Yeah.
The New Beverly is going to be closed
for quite a bit.
For like 8 months.
Yeah. They're renovating the heck out of it.
Yeah. And apparently there's only so much they can do because apparently the problem is the ceiling is sagging in a way that is blocking the light from the projecting booth and the screen. Yeah.
They got to fix.
But like if they wanted to actually tear off the roof and stuff, it would take like 2 years because, you know, they're jammed between two other buildings on a busy street.
Right.
And then apparently also if they do too much work on the building, they then have to become ADA certified.
What's ADA?
Americans with Disabilities Act.
Oh.
So they would
have
to.
Aren't
they
already? they're not.
Think about the bathrooms at the New Beverly.
You're right.
If you're in a wheelchair, you are not getting into that bathroom.
You can't get into that bathroom.
There's also not an elevator to the projection booth. So like they're grandfathered in as long as they don't change the space too radically.
Well, Tarantino's got the money.
Well, but I mean, that would be a thing of like, if they cross the line where they would have to become ADA certified, they would basically have to gut the whole place.
Well, then they might have to gut the whole place.
Yeah.
Again, he's rich.
Oh no, I know.
He can do it.
But it's just so
here's a more important question for me.
Yes.
Are the employees being paid during this time?
Whitney is.
They're paying Whitney.
Whitney
during
is.
This entire time.
Yes, because
that's all I care about.
Yes, because he is, and I.
Is Gariana working there too?
She is, and I hope she is also.
Is she getting paid too?
I hope so, because what they're paying Whitney to do is to. Apparently, Tarantino is constantly acquiring new 35 prints.
Right.
And so, Whitney's job, and he can do it. He can set his own hours in doing this. Is to sort of literally go through them manually and check their print quality, blah blah blah. So I'm hoping that Gariana can do that as well.
Gariana Abeda, who used to co-host
the Popcorn Mafia.
The Popcorn Mafia podcast back in the day.
Yes.
With Gray Drake, and that was
our introduction to the world of podcasting.
Our introduction to the world of podcasting. We were both guests separately on that show.
Yeah.
And when they quit and we picked up, we bought their equipment.
Yes.
Yeah. Little backstory there.
So,
and now Gariana is a projectionist
at the New Beverly.
At the New Beverly.
Among other places.
Yes. She's a woman about town.
She is indeed.
Yeah. So there. Renee. In the most recent episode, this is a letter from Renee. In the most recent episode, you received a letter from Russia in which the writer mentioned a preference for Dave. In an aside, and you commented that people frequently preferred Dave, and Alonzo lamented that it was his lot in life. Well, I just wanted to put in a word for Alonzo.
Oh, well, thank you.
Listen, I put in a word for Alonzo every damn day. I wake his ass up in the morning with a delicate little smooch to his face. He gets a bit of a cuddle, if I'm not too busy already. He gets breakfast made for him. I made that man buckwheat pancakes for breakfast this morning.
It's true.
Because the buckwheat was about to expire and the buttermilk was about to turn.
But come on.
What?
You know.
I know what? I know nothing.
Please.
All I know.
My own family likes you better than they like me. So, strangers certainly.
Well, they didn't marry you, did they? I guess I gave the ultimate seal of approval to you.
Carry on with Renee's
letter. By marrying you.
Just read Renee's letter.
Because of love.
Because I need to hear some adulation.
Here we go.
From a listener.
Here's some more adulation. I found this show because of Alonzo. He appeared on What the Flick to review African Cats. And I found him to be charming.
Oh, well,
me too. From the jump. He recommended that viewers watch the movie while wearing headphones and listening to Ladysmith's Black Mambazo, which cracked up both Christy and Matt. I thought to myself, I have to get more of this guy's reviews, and I have been hooked ever since.
Oh.
Love the show, Renee, formerly of Montreal, now in Brussels.
Oh, well, merci, Renee.
P.S. Alonso was right. European film looks so much better when you don't see the domestic schlock that never makes it to North America.
It's true. We get the best pickings.
Julius of the Solute, THE-SOLUTE.com.
Mm-hmm.
Hey guys, I was wondering if you saw that cult mashup movie Triple Fisher from a few years ago. No, I have not.
I've heard of it, but I've not seen it.
Before there was Tanya Harding, there was Amy Fisher, the Long Island Lolita, the teenage girl who tried to kill her older lover's wife. With Amy Fisher came three movies of the week, each representing a different take on the story. Amy Fisher's, The Buttafuoco's, and an unauthorized one in between. For Triple Fisher, director Dan Kapalowitz took these movies and mashed them into a super cut single movie to either represent a holistic truth or deconstruct the media narratives that happen around us. Right now seems like an even more prescient time to continue deconstructing media narratives. I agree. How does I, Tanya, compare against that type of deconstructionist structure? Different narrators take over different parts of the movie, but is I, Tanya, trying to be a high-class Rashomon, or is it something else entirely? What do we think about
Interesting
that?
Question. Yeah. I think with I, Tanya, it's more a question of telling and not showing, in terms of we get these interviews with different people who give us a different point of view, but then when we're shown events as they transpired in the past, the movie pretty much has an omniscient narrator, wouldn't you say? It's not like you see the same events multiple times
right.
in different people's versions.
Yeah.
But when the camera cuts to the interviews contradict each other.
Yes.
It's sort of how, it's what they promised and never delivered in Jersey Boys. Remember?
Oh, God. They just promised me a half-assedly decent movie.
Yeah,
in
they
Jersey
promised
Boys,
us entertainment
and
didn't give us that either.
Did not deliver.
But no, but they set up this premise where like each member of the band remembers things differently, but then they never explore that
right.
at all. And this one, at least, you do get the impression that Tanya remembers things one way, Galuli remembers things one way, the mother remembers things one way, and like the scummy tabloid journalist guy remembers things one way.
Right.
But again, when we're shown the events as they transpired, the movie just shows you one version.
Yes, I think you're right. I think that I, Tanya, does not go much in for breaking down what the media told us about that event.
It touches on it a little.
A little bit, but I think its primary purpose is to make you question what you might already know
right.
about it and feel for her.
Yeah, and to that respect, it's very much sort of upending the media narrative.
Yeah.
Because it does create sympathy for Tanya Harding, which the coverage certainly never did.
No. No, she was as monstrous as the
perpetrators.
The perpetrator, you know, the knee thwacker.
Yeah.
But, how does Nancy Kerrigan feel about this movie? Let's go to her. Let's go to her and find out. Because while I can appreciate the domestic background of Tanya Harding
mm-hmm.
and that feeling that she had, clearly that she had, that life was unfair.
Right.
And her abilities weren't being recognized properly, not only by her own family, but by the people whose job it was to judge impartially.
Right.
I get that.
Well, that's the thing.
I get that, but at the same time, I also get that Nancy Kerrigan didn't do anything. You know, she was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and was a manufactured, in Tonya Harding's head and in Jeff Galuli's head, a manufactured threat.
Yeah.
Could Nancy Kerrigan do the triple?
I mean, the thing about Itanya, and they don't really, I mean, they do touch on this to a certain extent, I guess. But, you know, if you are a great basketball player, if you can, like, slam dunk a ball or, like, you know, hit a three-pointer, whatever the things that a great basketball player can do, it doesn't matter where you're from. Doesn't matter how you were raised. It doesn't matter what your background is. But figure skating and, you know, ballroom dancing and, like, certain pursuits have this sort of imposed elegance.
Dressage.
To them. Yeah, dressage, exactly. You know, so, like you could be the greatest at the physical activity, but if you don't have the complete aesthetic package thereafter, you're sunk, you know.
Getting back to your letter, I think if Todd Haynes had directed this film, we would have seen something entirely different.
Ooh. Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a movie I'd like to see.
Yeah.
Todd Haynes' Itanya? Totally. Yeah.
Anyway. No, I thank you for that letter, Julian, because that's...
food for thought.
You could make an entirely other film about Tonya Harding and get a completely different story.
Yeah. Who were the three Amy Fishers? I don't remember. Like, Drew Barrymore was one.
Yeah.
And, like, Alyssa Milano?
Maybe.
And I can't remember the other one. Anyway. I didn't see any of these at the time.
JD says, just a quick note of thanks for the excellent discussion around The Last Jedi.
Hmm.
I would self-identify as a Star Wars fanboy, and I absolutely loved the new film, but it's been, shall we say, controversial among my friends. I think you did as good a job as anybody of discussing both the content of the film and the reaction to it. Also, thank you for the recommendation of 1208 East of Bucharest.
Oh, great.
I have the pleasure of traveling to Romania on work from time to time, and I'm always on the lookout for media that will help me learn more about the country. This was a terrific film with a sense of humor very reminiscent of my Romanian colleagues. And I probably would not have found it without your show. Keep up the great work.
Oh, cool. Well, yeah, there's a ton of great Romanian cinema.
The new Romanian cinema is shot through with that sense of, that particular sense of humor.
Yes.
Yeah.
The chuckles are bleak and dry.
And that is exactly 10 letters.
Yes.
So I quit. I quit this episode.
But we will we will dig back in to the old mailbag.
We're gonna
do this again.
Pop one out of this. I think a good plan to catch up is just do one a week until we get everybody's needs, wants, and concerns addressed.
Okay.
Good. Congratulations, Dave. What a good idea.
Very well. All right. Y'all are great. Thanks for listening. You
a little
can
short one here.
Yeah.
Like 45 minutes.
Yeah.
We haven't done that since 2011.
No kidding. you know, follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Leave us a nice review. We're going to be
five stars only.
Reading some new reviews on our next actual show. And
take your four-star reviews and go back home.
Put them in your pocket.
Bring me five.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife. You know, thank you for everybody who has tweeted or Facebooked or whatever to share the show. That is always great. And we'll be back this weekend with a look at...
this weekend is going to be quite exciting.
Yes, because not only are we still catching up on all of our year-end movies like Phantom Thread, I'll also be talking about the first new release of 2018, Insidious The Last Key. And Manola Dargis and Robert Abley will be here to talk about 2017 in film.
The best of the year.
That's right.
And I guess I'm going to post my list of favorite stuffs on Facebook.
Okay.
And possibly Twitter. I haven't been on Facebook or Twitter really since about end of September, beginning of October. I guess I'm going to go back.
All right.
And I don't know. Maybe.
You could just put it at linoleum-knife.com. I know no one goes to linoleum-knife.com, but we could send people there. Maybe they'd go for this.
Okay, sure, yeah. I don't know. You'll find it. It'll happen.
We'll let you know. Yeah. All right. So anyway, until next time.
Goodbye.